We are walking through the Gospel of Matthew. So if you're new with us, we've been kind of walking through this for a long time. And we're in chapter 17 of the 28, so we're like two-thirds of the way through the book. Matthew's about to slow down his storytelling to get us into Passion Week soon. But we're going to pick up on stuff still going on up in Galilee and the north with the stories today. We just have a few verses, nine verses today, not a large section, and with a disclaimer, I should have given this in the first service. This was one of those texts this week where I'm just like, I just don't know. I don't know exactly what to do with this text. And yet, my job is to stand up here and be like, this is what it means, here's all the things. And so, there's stuff in here I'm wrestling with, there's stuff in here that I'm still like going, oh, I'm still thinking about that. And maybe when I'm 70, like something will click and be like, oh, that's probably what that is. But it's the beauty of Scripture. Like, my job involved me coming to this text and being like, I know how all of this works all the time. Like, that's a terrible understanding of how the Bible should work. And yes, I have more of a background, more research, stuff like that, but I'm still in process on a lot of these things too. So there's expressions, idioms, sayings that we all encounter. And we encounter them in Scripture quite a bit. And if you know ancient Greek or know ancient Hebrew, you read them, and if you were an ancient Greek and Hebrew, you'd be like, yes, I know exactly what that means, and it does that. But for us to read it in modern day, the idioms often get lost on us. And we don't translate other idioms and other languages that often because it just doesn't make sense. Like, if you were learning another language and you go and someone says an idiom, most of the time you'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, I got a bunch of them here. Like, to say that you've tied a bear onto someone. I'm also supposed to be like, why would anybody tie a bear to someone? But if you're German, you go, oh, I know exactly what that means. And it means to, like, to trick someone, to fool someone, to tie a bear onto them. And we have a weird English saying for that, too, right? To pull the wool over someone's eyes. It's like, if you were to go somewhere else, it'd be like, why are you pulling wool over people's faces? Like, what does that have to do with things? And so, or to swallow some camels. We would never say that. It's a weird thing, but Norwegians say it, who don't have camels at all. But Norwegians say it as someone who, like, you finally give in to someone who's very persistent. You swallow the camels. If your cheeks have ever fallen off, which, once again, just sounds weird, but if you were in Japan and you ate something very delicious, you'd say, oh, my cheeks just fell off. And so it's just weird. Maybe we could figure out this one. When chickens have teeth, what does that sound like? Yeah, when pigs fly. Like, we have an English version of that. It's just a whole other country that would say when chickens have teeth. Not all donuts come with a hole, which simply means that things don't go the way that you like. And we have sometimes even English ones for that. Like, we say the plans jump the tracks, or life throws you a curveball. And if we were to say that to someone who doesn't speak English, they'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, why is life throwing something curvy at you and it's a ball? Or you have a wrench in your spokes or something like that. There's two that are my favorite here at the end. The raisin at the end of the hot dog. Yeah, exactly. And most of us would be like, what is going on? And it makes sense when you explain it. It's Icelandic. And it means like a surprise ending, something that was unexpected at the end of something. And so a raisin at the end of the hot dog would be certainly a surprise ending. And this one is by far my favorite. To slide in on a prawn sandwich, which is weird as can be. And I don't understand why it means this, but it's Swedish to mean like to have an easy life, to have a life that is pretty easy. We might say to be born with a silver spoon in your mouth, which also, once again, to a non-English speaker, you'd be like, why is someone born with silverware in their mouth? And we can go on and on, but Scripture does these things quite often. And most of the time, the translators do you the favor, right? They actually translate it into something that would make sense in our language. But it's all over the place. Like, even just taking the start of the Bible, we have things like, his face was fallen. It's like, what does that mean? Well, it simply means that they were sad. There's fallenness. Or someone with the length of two noses. Like, if you describe someone, oh, that person has the length of two noses to them. You'd be like, what is that? And it simply means that they're patient. But it's a Hebrew idiom. It's a phrase that's there. And I think we encounter a little bit of that today when we start talking about mountains and the moving of mountains, that there might be more idiom happening in the language than sort of the literalcy of Jesus expecting us to be able to literally pray for mountains to move. And I think it starts shading somewhat of how we interpret. Because, I hear all sorts of interpretation around some of these texts. That we just need more faith, like Daniel was saying. We just have to have more faith. That thing didn't happen because your faith just wasn't big enough. You need to believe deeper or bigger. But I'm not sure that's at all what Jesus is actually saying in the text. Let's remember the context just to set us up well. Recently, Jesus has taken his collection of disciples up to Caesarea Philippi, the north side of Israel, quite a bit north, basically on the border. And he goes to this city that's heavily pagan at the time, that has its own giant rock face, that has its own gates of Hades in the place that this is happening. It's a pagan world. And he's telling his disciples that he's going to build his church. In the face of the gates of Hades and this pagan world, and the power of the influence of the Greeks and the Romans and everything that's been coming into their world, that Jesus is going to build his church. And all of that world's not going to overcome it. I would argue this is one of Jesus' most grandiose statements around his kingship. Because he said other things, right? My kingdom is going to be like yeast in some bread. Or a mustard seed, which we get another one here. Or like a field, and some wheat, and there's some weeds, and they're growing together. It's going to be like that. And so his disciples have not heard the most grandiose things up to this point, but here, this statement is a statement of triumph. I'm going to plant my church. I'm going to have my people, my kingdom people, and nothing, even this Roman and pagan world, is not going to overcome it. It's a big statement. And then he takes a few of his disciples up the mountain, and they have this incredibly affirming moment that Jesus is, yes, the Messiah, but he seems to be so much more. They've seen him be this man who's able to perform these incredible miracles, but then they see so much more on that mountain. They seem to realize there's something divine at least happening in this moment. I don't think they've put together the Trinity yet. I don't think they are like, he is the second person of the Trinity of the Godhead. I don't think any of that's happening for these disciples yet, but they do realize that he is more than the Messiah they expected. They're trying to piece it together. But then he's also throwing statements around about how he's going to have to die. And that just like John the Baptist, he's going to die. And he's, so it's like whiplash for these disciples. It's like, my kingdom, nothing's going to stand against it, but I'm going to go to Jerusalem and die. And I'm God in this miraculous way, in this human way, living on earth in this sort of Sinai moment. And the way that John went is the way I'm going to have to go to. It's like, oh, what do you do with that? How do you absorb all of that? And that's the backstory we start the story in. And when they came to the crowd, the man came up to him and kneeling before him, said, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often in the water. And I brought him to your disciples and they could not heal him. So the tension is established with the son and this man who's desperately wants to help his son. As I said, the disciples have had power to cast out demons before, so what is going on that they couldn't? And Jesus answered, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. So this is very Old Testament language. Numbers, Deuteronomy, it's almost like direct quotes of things that either God or Moses has said. Both of them have said it. God says it around when he basically says, hey, a whole bunch of you are never going to make it to the promised land. Some of you younger guys, sure. But because of your collective grumbling, your collective not getting who I am, some of you are not going to make it into the promised land. And then Moses does the same thing a little bit where he's sort of like, God, how much longer are you going to make me lead these people? He sort of has this sort of moment being frustrated with his people. And I still wrestle a bit with Jesus' harsh response. But I think the Moses parables are important here. Because if the transfiguration last week, and we kind of talked about it, is almost like the Sinai moment, where Moses meets with God at the top of Mount Sinai, what happens when Moses leaves his meeting with God? Yeah, he comes down the mountain and he finds everybody being like, hey, we know how this works. We're going to set up worship because this is what we do. We've been in Egypt for 400 years. We know how worship works. You set up a monument and you worship to it. All sorts of different ways you can worship to it. But that's what happens. And so they did what they know. Not what they were instructed to do, but just what they know. And Jesus comes down the mountain, much like to Moses, and finds the disciples just doing what they know again. And perhaps that's the story here. And perhaps the parallels are there for Matthew to be like, this is like a Moses moment for Jesus to once again just find the people that should be getting this, who should be understanding this, and just finding them lacking something. But as I said, there's just not enough. I want more in the story to like plant my flag very firmly there. But we just don't know. Perhaps that's at play here in Matthew's telling of the story of coming down the mountain. And we even find that verse that is missing in other gospels, the sort of this that the healing can only be happened through prayer and fasting, which often both carry with them the very sense of like humility as opposed to like, I got this. Perhaps that's at play, that there's sort of a pride of the disciples being like, we know how this works, we got this, it's ours. And perhaps that's Jesus being like, look, you don't got this, guys. and when you think you have it, you don't. When you don't think you have it, it's probably when you do. And perhaps he's just frustrated that he's teaching and leading up to his death moment. And he's like, you guys still aren't getting this. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him. And the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? So Jesus does what he does. He does what he's been doing throughout the Gospels. He's able to drive out what is evil and wicked. That's what he does. And the disciples want to know why it didn't work for them. And he said to them, because of your little faith, for truly I say to you, you have faith like the grain of a mustard seed. If you have faith like the grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible to you. So this last phrase, I want to camp out more. I think the vagueness of the stuff before is a little harder to deal with, but this is a little bit simpler. Now, once again, did Jesus say that we have to have big faith? Not exactly, right? Little faith, because you have little faith, well, then just have little faith. If you had little faith, then you could say to this mountain, move. So it's peculiar. It's a puzzle a little bit of what Jesus says. And I think this is where we get ourselves mixed up and get to bad teaching. Because the natural thinking that most of us would have out of that is to ask whether our faith is up to the task. But Jesus literally just said we don't need mountain-sized faith to move the mountain. That's not what we're instructed. And if they were near Caesarea Philippi still, I mean, he could literally point to Mount Hermon, which is the tallest mountain in all of Israel, snow-capped year-round. And if you need faith equal to the task of this 9,000-foot mountain, it's going to crush you. No, it's just not going to work that way. But Jesus says, you know, a little faith will work here. And one more nugget of context around moving mountains. And perhaps there's a double entendre happening here. I think there's two things happening. And I think it's reinforcing that Jesus is not really talking about moving physical mountains. Sometimes people overplay what the text says. The first is that there's a rabbinic saying that would refer to people as uprooters of mountains, people that are able to move a mountain. So a rabbi who was able to like seemingly take like an impossible argument or thought or kind of circumstance and work it out to find a solution, they would be considered, one of the nomenclatures for them are that they are people who can uproot a mountain, who are able to move a mountain. And so I think there's possibly that at play, people that can look at impossible odds and go, I think I understand how that works. And then second, and this will definitely come up later in Matthew, maybe not so much here, but we did have one person in history who was able to literally move a mountain. And that was Herod the Great. We'll find this later when Jesus is in Jerusalem. He'll bring this up again. But you had it, an individual who was over all of Israel at the time, who was the powers to be, who had multi-generations of family kind of ruling over these people. And this man, because of his paranoia, had moved literally so much dirt to create a small mountain and build a palace on it because he was always worried that someone was going to chase after him. So he created all these palaces. And you can actually see it from Jerusalem, the Herodium way off in the distance. And so you had someone who was ruling, who had just killed Jesus' cousin, his son had killed Jesus' cousin, who were the powers that be. And yet Jesus is like, I'm going to build my church. And perhaps that's at play in this as well. The faith is not just working up enough confidence in order to smash a mountain. That's just not faith. And as we read the rest of the New Testament, that's just not how faith is presented. As if it's like this manipulative game, that if I can just do enough, then God will respect that enough to do something back for me. That's like the opposite of the gospel. That's like a workspace understanding of a vending machine or something like that. It's like, if I just have $2 as opposed to $1, I can get that higher-end candy versus like the, I can get the baked good versus the chips in 1 ounce bag, right? But that's not at all how it's presented. Faith is consistently presented around sort of the trusting of the God who speaks, the God who makes promises, the God who delivers, who designs the world as it is, and designs you and me and says, this is what is true. This is how it works. This is how it will be. To believe in that God, to believe in what he's accomplished, that's faith. And God in the Old Testament and throughout Jesus in the gospel, like, what has he said? What are these things? And I think Matthew has certainly presented us that there's going to be an end of what is evil. That eventually what is evil and wicked and sin and all that will eventually fully go away. And the demonic oppression of this child is like, even in the presence of this Jesus in this moment, it's not going to win the day. Heaven has authority over those things. That's what we've been told. That's what we have faith in. And maybe it's a little less like the quantity of their faith, but who their faith is in, the object of their faith. Once again, remember, Jesus told his disciples, I'm going to build my church. The gates of Hades are never going to prevail against it. And I'm going to die. Who's ready to take up the cross with me? Victory and defeat for these guys are all rolled up in one. It's got to be a puzzle. For them, it's like, how? How is this possibly going to happen, Jesus? And I think Jesus is saying, look, guys, it's actually not going to take as much as you think. The pagan influence of Rome and Greece, it's terribly oppressive, abusive worship of power and sexuality, or the violent practices and anxiety-riddled world of Herod who ruled over the area. Guys, these will all be conquered. Those mountains, those obstacles, those things that you think are truly unmovable, I'm going to build my church. Do you believe it? Because he's instructed them, you are my church. These things are not going to be impossible for you. I'm going to do this through y'all. And let's make sure the you in this whole section is a y'all, which we often miss too. This is not how I individually am going to conquer the mountains. It's how y'all, the church, the collective, will conquer these mountains. Nothing will be impossible for y'all. But we have to remember the context once again. Because the question is, do we have the power to do whatever we want? If nothing's going to be impossible? Well, no, we have the power to do what Jesus wants. Because we parallel him. Jesus has all authority and power, right? Every obstacle to heaven's authority on earth, Jesus has authority over, right? But we have to watch how Jesus uses that full power and authority. He didn't use it to remove the human rulers who oppose his authority while walking around here on earth. He didn't go to Jerusalem and be like, guys, get out of here. And I have the ability to do that. Herod, I know you're interrogating me. I'm going to strike you dead right now. He didn't do that. He didn't cast out the temple authorities. Nothing was impossible for him. But that's not how he uses his authority. Because where does Matthew go for the very next thing that Jesus will once again remind us of? He goes, nothing is impossible for you guys, and we're going to go, we're going to conquer. Oh no, my tablet just shut off, the power died. My notes are right back there in the back corner. Nothing is impossible for you, nothing's going to stand in your way. But then he immediately goes to verse 22. And the Son of Man is about to be delivered to the hands of men, and they will kill him. and he would be raised on the third day. And they were greatly distressed. So victory, celebration, death. And his pain, his death, is so connected to the victory. He's frustrated in a generation that mistrusts, I think, his very way. It's like, here's the way, guys. I need you to start seeing this. And I think they're still just not getting it. He's like, how long? How long is this going to take? And Jesus' authority does move mountains. But those don't happen right away, right? It takes a while for Rome and Greece. It takes a while for Herod. Not that long for Herod, but it takes a little while. We get there in the book of Acts. But in the end, every valley will be raised. Every mountain will be made low. But he doesn't do it in his life as the bulldozer. He's not blasting haughty mountains of explosives or expletives in his life. He's establishing heaven's authority on earth by giving his life. It's the only possible way to represent his father's authority. It's like, you want to watch authority? Watch me lay down my life. You want to see what this kingdom's really about? Take up your cross. And he gives us a means. And I know this is very repetitive from 2 weeks ago, but I think this is still what's at hand here. And too often we want to go seize, we want to grab, we want to do things that we think that it should be done this way. And hear me, some of those things are great. I want God to deal with my enemies. I want God to fix my spouse. I want God to return the money that was stolen. I want God to give me that promotion. I want God to give me a good doctor's report. Hear me, all those things are wonderful to pray for. Go ahead, ask all day long. But God's authority, the cross-shaped life that we are invited into as well, calls us into an upside-down world that sometimes suffers in the face of evil. And the prosperity teachers lost the context of the cross. It's like, you have the authority to move mountains. Nothing will be impossible for you. So let's go to Jerusalem and die. But do we think that that means that way? The way that Jesus will deal with Satan and evil and bind and pay for sin was so backwards, yet in it, we get life. By faith, we get life and victory and reconciliation. We get all of the things. And when we look at a world that is full of suffering and war and diseases that take children before their life unfolds, where the rich and powerful might gorge themselves while others starve, while crime and injustice seem like insurmountable mountains, what is our faith in that? And is it fine being a mustard seed in the face of insurmountable odds? And in the face of the injustice of those who refuse to submit to heaven's authority, guess what? The Lamb is leading the world back under heaven's reign. We're able to declare with Jesus' mom that he has brought down rulers from their thrones and he has lifted up the humble. There's no more Caesars. There's no more Herods. And God continues to build his church. And nothing can stand against it. Satan's been dethroned. Nothing is impossible under heaven's authority. And there is prosperity that does come when Jesus is king and evil is destroyed. But let's be cautious that we don't just fast forward to the end to forget the very means that Jesus invites us into. It's repetitive. I'm fine with that. Sometimes we just love to seize power, control. If we just get our right political party in office, this will all solve our problems. If we just get the right policies in place, the right education, the right things, if we just have all these things, then the kingdom can come. And I wonder, I mean, I said this at the first service, but like, I don't really want the church to experience like legitimate persecution again here in America, but I kind of want the church to experience legitimate persecution again. And what I mean by that is just, like, I think we get some of our theology and some of the things we just like conflated a little too often of how we think the kingdom works. And too often, I mean, there are books like 2 Corinthians that we just like don't preach very often because the whole book's about how to suffer. And we don't like that. But Paul's like, that is the way. And I wonder if we read a text like this and immediately go to prosperity. And I think for so many historically, they'd be like, what? No. And that we see his kingdom as it is, and the kind of king that he is, the way he wants to usher in his kingdom, and that we start living those things, same things out, and believe that through sacrificial love, through putting others before myself, through giving away just because you just want to be the generous person, you're willing to sacrifice it all, like even by acts, where they're like, I'll sell whatever fields I own if that helps. And in that, find out that nothing is impossible. Not just by mustering up more prayer. We just need a revival. We need this room full. We need a whole week where we're worshiping nonstop and praying nonstop. I'm for revivals. Really wrong with them. But if we think the world's only going to change if we do something like that, then I think we're missing out on perhaps what Jesus is actually getting after. The kind of people he actually wants us to be, not just the kind of events he wants us to put on.